CQCQ, this is Kilo Delta Zero, Charlie Delta Quebec. Whether I want to believe that my clock on my cell phone or the clock on my computer, it's about time to start. What are we going to start? We're starting now with Welcome to the Outreach Program, sponsored by the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This program has been established to help those wishing to learn more about our hobby and further assisting those wishing to upgrade their license status. The program tonight will be an in-depth course pertaining to what one should know when studying for the extra class license. This course will be conducted with two sessions weekly, which will be at 7 p.m. 2300 Zulu each Tuesday and at 7 p.m. 2300 Zulu each Sunday evening. Letting it drop. Now, for those who are already licensed and wish either a refresher course or would just like to listen, please contact us at SCARS. Server at either EchoLink node number 96140 or IRLP node 9614. I won't read the rest of them. It gets too involved. For those who are interested, please contact myself, Mike, Kilo Delta Zero, Charlie Delta Quebec, via email at voip@scars.com. That's Sierra, Charlie, Alpha, Romeo, Sierra, Victor, Oscar, Mike, Papa.com to enroll in the class and be given directions as the study material required and the manner you will be connecting into the course. The material being presented is formatted from data obtained from the AWRL and is simply being forwarded in the presentation format by SCARS. Should anyone take issue with some of the technical questions, statements made, and in keeping with not interrupting the class in session, please convey your comments or suggestions to the outreach program at VOIP at scarsvoip.com. Let me get right. It should be mentioned that this course covers only requirements contained to the United States Port 97 rules and does not include other requirements that may be found in foreign countries. Should any other country other than the United States wish to have their own licensing session on this server, please drop us an email at VOIP.scarsvoip.com. The session this evening will be recorded and posted on our website at www.scarsvoip.com. Please note, for all of our class members and instructors, it's extremely important that we all stay on the same page during these classes. The only question pool and copies thereof that should be used when participating in this class should be the one found posted on our website. Publications from other sources may or may not be current and should not be used during our session. Do we have any emergencies or out of the ordinary business that needs to be handled before we start this evening's program? Okay, in the box at the bottom of your screen on the right, I will be entering the question number. So in case you get confused and you're on the wrong question, the right question should be showing in the box. So, at this point, we will begin. And who are we going to begin? We're going up to the beautiful state of Maryland, where I lived for 16 years. I love that state. We're going to November, Oscar, November, yeah, Oscar 7, Oscar, which is George in Nottingham, Maryland. So we're going to go to him for the first question. So get yourself ready, and here we go. Over to you, George, KD0CDQ.
KD0CDQ and the South Cars Extra Class Review Course, NO70, George in Nottingham, Maryland. And thank you so much for those nice words, Mike. This is a beautiful area to live in with lots of beautiful wildlife and natural scenes, as well as being a rather busy area as well for industrial and other affairs. So thank you so much for that compliment to my new home. All right, very good. So welcome again to each one of you that has taken the time to join us for this extra class review course. I want to thank you for being here, applaud you for your time and effort for taking time out of your day to join us. Obviously, those that are preparing for the exam, this should help you a lot. For those that are coming by just for a review or to improve your knowledge, congratulations again on your decision. All right, our first question this evening is E4C03, Echo 4, Charlie 03. The question reads, What is the term for the suppression in an FM receiver of one signal by another stronger signal on the same frequency? Our choices are desensitization, cross-modulation interference, capture effect, or frequency discrimination. So let's discuss what we think is the answer to that. But you know, before I give the answer, this is a fairly well-known phenomenon with FM transmissions, and I'll bet someone in the class out there knows the answer. Let me invite any one of you who would like to take a chance at coming with the answer, or just say hello. Looking for someone to come in for an answer for this question, please call now. This is NL70. Over. All right, now we're nothing heard, so let's discuss this question and then we'll look at the answer. When two FM signals are received at the same time at an antenna, the stronger of the two signals will suppress the weaker of the two signals. Now, with these FM signals, they're both frequency modulated with the same amplitude. It is only the change in frequency from the audio signal that is demodulated and heard in the speakers. Because both signals have the same amplitude, but one is stronger in strength than the other, then the stronger signal's frequency deviations are detected and demodulated. Therefore, the stronger signal suppresses the weaker signal's presence, and the stronger signal is the one that is heard. So the receiving end of the FM receiver just naturally picks up the stronger of the two signals. Therefore, the stronger signal captures the receiver's front end, and that is the signal that you hear. Therefore, the answer will be capture effect. Capture effect. Are there any questions that anyone on the class tonight might have about this? Please call now, 070. Over. All right, nothing heard. And by the way, that answer does apply to any FM signal, not only on ham frequencies, but wherever FM signals are used. All right, our next question is E4C10, Echo 4 Charlie number 10. And the question reads, what is an advantage of having a variety of receiver IF bandwidths from which to select? Now, you may recall that you can move a knob on that or use a software selection to change the receiver IF bandwidth. Let me reset. Our choices are the noise figure of the RF amplifier can be adjusted to match the modulation type, thus increasing receiver sensitivity. Second answer possible answer, receiver power consumption can be reduced when a wider bandwidth is not required. Third answer as a possible advantage, receive bandwidth can be set to match the modulation bandwidth, maximizing the signal-to-noise ratio and minimizing interference. And the last possible answer, multiple frequencies can be received simultaneously if desired. Would anyone like to give us the answer to this question? Please call now, NL70. Over. Nothing heard as well. I hope I'm not keying too quickly for those on some of the links. Let's discuss this question and then look at the answer. All right, if one signal has a wider bandwidth that includes additional signals not a part of the desired communication, then because of the multiple signals, the observed signal will be noisier than a signal that has less undesired content in it. When the bandwidth is closely matched to the modulation bandwidth, the extra undesired content takes up less of the modulated signal, thereby enhancing the desired contents. The received bandwidth can therefore be set to match the modulation bandwidth, minimizing interference and maximizing the signal-to-noise ratio. Therefore, the answer would be the third one given that reads as an advantage of having a variety of receiver IF bandwidths would be that receive bandwidth can be set to match the modulation bandwidth, thereby maximizing the signal-to-noise ratio and minimizing interference from other signals. So that is the second question for tonight. Let me reset. And with that, it is my distinct pleasure to, as a plebe or not anywhere up around the rank of a retired Navy chief, to still pipe aboard Chief W4RFJ, who is in that strange land of Pennsylvania. And so talk about beautiful land. Oh, my goodness, it's beautiful up there. So Chief is here also, and it's a pleasure to share the class responsibilities tonight with Chief, and he has some good questions for you coming up. So, Chief W4RFJ, hello there, teacher mate, classmate, shipmate, how you doing? And it's getting foggy in the studio here. W4RFJ, NO70, over.
NO70 with the extra class group. This is W4RFJ. Hello, Sheriff. And this next question I'm going to be dealing with is Echo 4, Charlie 12, E4C12. And again, welcome everybody. Sure, I'm glad you're here. Which of the following has the largest effect on an SDR or software-defined radio receiver's dynamic range? So this is looking for the largest effect on an SDR receiver's dynamic range. You have the answers available. We have the CPU register width in bits. We have anti-aliasing input filter bandwidth. And then we have RAM speed used for data storage. And last but not least, analog to digital converter sample width in bits. Now this can be pretty confusing, but if we put things into, generally speaking, the dynamic range is the ratio between the strongest and the weakest signal that can be received. In a digital signal, the dynamic range is determined by the number of bits per sample. The strongest signal is one which uses the full range of the sample values, and the weakest signal is one which uses only two adjacent values. That's adding one bit or subtracting one bit of change. In a software-defined radio, the analog signal level fed into the analog-to-digital converter must be adjusted either manually or by an automatic gain control, /AGC, to make best use of the available dynamic range. So, which of the following has the largest effect on an SDR receiver's dynamic range? The answer is analog to digital converter sample width in bits. I hope that cleared up any cloudy pictures anybody might have had. George, Sheriff, it's back over to you for Echo 4D03. This is W4RFJ.
W4RFJ and the South Cars Extra Class Review on Tuesday evening, NO70. Welcome back, or welcome to each one of you, and glad to have you here. Thank you, Chief. It sure is good to hear your voice tonight. And heard you check in earlier, and it's good to hear you there. All right, Echo 4D03. The question reads, how can intermodulation interference between two repeaters occur? All right, let me repeat that question. How can intermodulation interference between two repeaters occur? All right, here are our possible answers. When the repeaters are in close proximity and the signals cause feedback in the final amplifier of one or both transmitters. The second possibility is when the repeaters are in close proximity and the signals mix in the final amplifier of one or both transmitters. The third answer is when the signals from the transmitters are reflected out of phase from airplanes passing overhead. And the fourth answer is when the signals from the transmitters are reflected in phase from airplanes passing overhead. All right, let's break this down. When two repeaters are close together, each repeater can mix itself with the other repeater's signal in the final RF amplifier, thereby causing the intermodulation interference. This is why the old Cold War over-the-horizon radars require both the transmit and receive antennas to be close to each other, but still have some distance of separation to avoid interference with each other. So if you think about the fact that those radars used to have to be close by but separated, one can remember that the answer to the question is to think of repeaters too close together, like two radar station antennas too close to each other, and that requires some way to suppress the interfering RF signal at each of the other repeaters' location. Let me reset. So the answer to this question then, how can intermodulation interference between two repeaters occur, will be the second choice, when the repeaters are in close proximity and the signals mix in the final amplifier of one or both transmitters. All right, so that's intermodulation interference for repeaters. Let's go back to Chief W4RFJ, and he has a couple of nice questions for you. W4RFJ, NO70, over.
Okay, NO70, this is W4RFJ. And my next question here is Echo 4 Delta 04. And I'll read the question. Which of the following may reduce or eliminate intermodulation interference in a repeater caused by another transmitter operating in close proximity? This is kind of a takeoff from the last question that George was talking about. How do we prevent it? How do we reduce it? The answers are a bandpass filter in the feed line between the transmitter and the receiver, a properly terminated circulator at the output of the repeater's transmitter. Another option is utilizing a Class C final amplifier, and last but not least, utilizing a Class D final amplifier. Let me grab a nickel here and see if anybody wants to take a stab at this one. This is W4RFJ calling all students. Care to take a stab at this question? This is W4RFJ. Please come on in.
It's a little quiet, so KD9NDJ is going to take a crack at this, even though he barely understands it.
KD9NDJ from W4RFJ. Well, thanks for stepping up to the plate there, shipmate. Nice to meet you there, Ken. So what do you think the answer is, W4RFJ?
I think the answer is B, the requirement to add a circulator. I'm not completely sure I know what a circulator is because I've never quite heard that expression before, but it seems to me that the other answers just don't make any sense. By process of elimination, I'm going for the circulator. KD9NDJ.
Well, KD9NDJ, this is W4RFJ with South Cars. And your answer is actually correct, and I'll explain to you what a circulator is. The answer that calls for a bandpass filter in the feed line between the transmitter and the receiver, that may that may help, but it's not really taking care of intermodulation interference. Utilizing a Class C amplifier would actually add more noise into the signal. Class D may or may not, depending on the design, but the answer is definitely a properly terminated circulator. A circulator is a three-port device that allows signals to flow in a particular direction. I think it's usually clockwise, if I'm not mistaken, from one port to the next. So if you took, let's put on our imaginary caps. Let me grab a nickel. All right, let's say we got a pipe that's in a circle. And up at the top is a port where we can actually look into that pipe. We'll call that A. 120 degrees clockwise is port B. And my pen stopped working. That's not good. And then 120 degrees from port B is port C. So the transmitter would go into port A and automatically come out port B. That's where your antenna would be, right? And if there was any reflective energy coming back from the antenna, it would go to port C, which would have a 50 ohm load on it. Okay, so that's what the circulator does. Mainly it gets rid of any SWR or any reflected power, and it doesn't allow it to get back into the transmitter because it's being dissipated in a dummy load. Let me grab another nickel. Now let's say you have an adjacent transmitter and that signal's coming in through the antenna. Well, with the circulator and that signal coming in port B, it would get dissipated into a 50 ohm load before it gets to the transmitter port. So that's where the circulator is involved. Now, the wavelength form of a circulator consists of those three arms 120 degrees apart, at the center of which is placed a slab of ferrite, which is magnetically biased by a permanent magnet. The ferrite effectively rotates the standing wave pattern so that the coupling can only occur in one direction. So there's no way for the signal to get from port B to port A from that real close transmitter. It'll actually go to port C first and be dissipated by the load. What do you think, Ken? Do you have any questions on that, or did I explain or edumacate you well with that? Over.
That's a pretty good explanation, but the question that popped into my head was what electronic method does the circulator use to do that? That would help me recall the answer on the exam.
Well, I thought I'd explain that. I don't think I could paint an easy picture. You almost have to push that I believe button. The rotation or the path that the RF energy goes in and out. Of course, again, port A would be the transmitter from the repeater. Port B would be out to the antenna. Port C would have a dummy load capable of handling the however much power your transmitter's putting out. So if you have any SWR component going in from port A and going circularly, it would try to get out port B, but if there's reflective energy, instead of going back into the transmitter, it would be dissipated in port C. Now, when you talk about taking that same circulator, which has got a ferrite core or a magnet in there that's causing the circular pattern, when the RF energy comes in from the antenna at port B, before it can get to going in the same circular, right-hand circular rotation, before it can get to port A, which is the transmitter, which is where the intermods would be developed, that energy coming from the antenna gets dissipated at port C. Does that make sense?
KD9NDJ here with a response to your response. It makes sense, but I'm gathering from that the circulator is the three-port structure. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So if you picture in your mind a tube that's in a circle, and it has these ports A, B, and C, 120 degrees apart, right? And then the magnetic material in the middle of it, I have never torn one of these apart, so I don't know how it physically works. I just know that that circulator protects for two things. One, it protects from allowing frequencies from real close by transmitters from getting into the transmitter of the repeater by dissipating, you know, between port B and A going in the circular pattern has port C in between, which is going to capture that RF energy and dissipate it in a dummy load. So that, and if there's any SWR coming back, any reflected energy coming back from the antenna, it'll also dissipate in the dummy load. Okay? So you almost have to push the I believe button back there and know that a circulator has three antenna ports and it goes in a clockwise direction. Port A would be the transmitter, port B would be the antenna, port C would be a dummy load, normally 50 ohms, which is what normal antenna circuits use. Did that help?
I'll take it. Thank you very much, KD9NDJ.
Now, I know being an electronic specialist and having played with Trons for 30-plus years, you know, sometimes you just got to push the I believe button, and as long as you understand how that circulator works, and you can do some research on that, too. Do a Google search for repeater circulators, and I think the ARRL handbook has a lot of information about that also. All right, if there's no other questions, let me break for a second, see if anybody else has a question. If not, we'll move on to the next question. This is W4RFJ looking for inquiries to question E4D04.
N070 comment?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chief. Okay, so if I'm understanding you correctly as well, and I think I heard another question in his that people may have heard. With the circulator, am I correct that there is not any additional electronic circuitry inside the circulator, that this is purely the circulator itself with the three ports and a ferrite slab inside? Let me reset here to finish the thought and ask you if I'm on the right track. Resetting. Chief, an example that comes to mind since is the physics example that we all had when we passed a magnet through a coiled wire, then that set up an electromagnetic field, of course, generated electricity in the coil. So that was not an additional circuit. It just was the physics of the energy itself. So am I correct then in thinking that there's no additional electronic circuitry inside the circulator? It's simply the ports, the RF energy in with the ferrite slab, and then the behavior as you described, and that the only energy going in is the transmitted energy. How close am I, please, Chief? W4FJ, N070, over.
Well, you know, it's the hardest part to understanding circulators is in that there is some wavelength issues. You know, there's lengths or, you know, I'm trying to figure out the best way to explain this. The only way I can really picture it in my mind, if you've ever heard of a helical duplexer, normally used in a 6-meter repeater, they have loops that basically work out like circulators in that, you know, you have quarter wavelength and half wavelength and all that stuff. It can get pretty complicated. But my point is that there is some, I guess for lack of better words, cavities that are tuned at whatever wavelength that is tuned for within the circulator. So I know that has something to do with it too. But I would assume that what you said was pretty accurate. Over.
Well, thank you, Chief. I appreciate checking that analogy with you. Back to you, W4FJ, NL70.
Simple, make it fun. Kissmith, a circulator is a device that has three ports, port A, B, and C. And if you hook up port A for a repeater, a circulator is used to protect the transmitter if something happens to the antenna. In other words, if the antenna were taken away and you had a circulator that was feeding port A, port B is all, now disconnected, okay, where's all that energy going to go? Well, it's going to get dissipated off port C before it can get back around to port A. Did that make it simple?
I believe that helps also in our 7-0.
All right. Well, I hope everybody understands and can get something out of that. It should make it fairly simple to know that a circulator is a properly terminated circulator is what we're looking for in that answer, in that question. Okay, my next question, let me break here for a second and reset the timers. Okay, Echo 4 Delta 1-2. What is the term for the reduction in receiver sensitivity caused by a strong signal near your receiver's frequency? We have desensitization, we have quieting, we have cross-modulation interference, and we also have squelch gain rollback. Anybody, any of the students care to take a stab at that one? Please call W4RFJ looking for a response for Echo 4D12.
Six, Victor.
Victor, good morning, Captain. Oh, wait a minute, it's not morning. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, it's too late for the wake-up call. Hey, thanks, Chief. Good show, guys. KY6V here. Spend just a moment on your last question on circulators. I think pointing towards Ken's questions, too, is the fact that you've got to think about the wave spacing, okay? Roger has mentioned several times that each port is spaced 120 degrees beyond the previous port. Well, three 120s, it brings you back to dead center or the top again. So if you think about the fact that these circulators at the additional ports are working at 120 degrees removed, gives them ability to do some flexibility in dumping what they don't want to see into a dummy load. So basically, I would consider that. On your current question, desensitization is my answer. And I would suggest here that people who have worked with repeaters or are starting to get interested in building their own repeaters, 2 meters, 440, whatever, this is a big consideration. Your transmitter is right next to your receiver and they're both running at exactly the same time. So if there's any bleed over in the spacing, and you know, 2 meters is normally 600 kc, so if any of the transmitter frequency gets into the receiver frequency, then it desensitizes it holds off the ability to hear weaker signals coming in through the receiver. So you have diplexers and duplexers and all kinds of ways to get around that, but It's one signal taking over from another that you didn't want to be there in the first place. Go ahead, Roger. KY6V, over.
And KY6V, this is W4RFJ with the group. And I couldn't have said it better myself. Pretty much one of the things you got to look at is that the front end of the receiver, if you didn't have the duplexers in place, and you're transmitting and receiving simultaneously through the same antenna, with the same antenna connected, that signal, that transmitter signal, would basically just fill up the RF energy that the amplifier can handle. So once you've filled up that RF amplification circuit with so much RF energy, it becomes desensitized to any of the weaker signals. So that's kind of the way I look at it. It's filled up the RF front end of the receiver to the point that weaker signals cannot get in. And has anybody got any questions concerning question Echo 4D12? Please call W4RFJ.
Okay, hearing none, we'll move on to the fun one. I kind of picked this because of the issues that every normal, everyday HF operator, actually VHF, UHF operator can have with shielded cables. Which of the following can cause shielded cables to radiate or receive interference? Let me grab a nickel. The answers we have to choose from is low inductance ground connections at both ends of the shield, common mode currents on the shield and conductors. Let's see, the third answer we have to choose from is use of braided shielding material. And last but not least, tying all ground connections to a common point resulting in a differential mode currents in the shield. All right. So this is going to be a pretty tough one to explain, but I think once you guys and gals get an idea of what we're trying to look at here, does anybody want to take a stab at this question for the answer? Please call W4RFJ.
Well, I'll tell you what. Six Victor, over.
Go ahead, Captain. The floor is yours. The microphone, too.
Well, muchas gracias, senor. I'm going to say that the answer is B on what they've given us here, which is called common mode currents. I grew up calling them ground loops. I'll tell you a quick story. The first car I had was a 6-volt Mercury convertible. 1941, guys and gals. 6-volt system. And I put a 10-meter transmitter that was crystal controlled in the trunk of this convertible. I decided that I was going to get fancy, and I ran a multiple conductor cable from the trunk up to the dashboard that had the selector panel on it where I could change frequencies, and the way I did that was a stepper switch located in the trunk. Well, anyway, I put this baby together, and I ended up with a hellacious hum. I mean, it was out of sight. And no matter what I did, I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. So my father, who was my Elmer, came by and asked how things were going. I said, I'm having trouble. And he says, what is it? I explained it, and he looked in the trunk, and he says, pick this ground wire off of ground and see what happens. And the hum disappeared. End of story. KY6V. Go ahead, Roger.
Okay, well, your answer is common mode currents on the shield and conductors is correct. And I guess looking at it from another aspect... yeah, those ground connections can really throw you for a loop. Get it? Well, anyway. Coaxial cables with shields more than several skin depths thick. Always carry equal and opposite flowing currents on the inside of the shield and their center conductors. The current direction and current ratio between the center conductor and the inside of the shield in a non-radiating coaxial line is no different than the currents in each conductor of a perfectly balanced ladder line. In both unbalanced coaxial lines and balanced lines, the two conductors making up the line carry equal and opposite flowing currents. So that's carry equal and opposite flowing currents. When currents flow without close by opposing currents, we call the unopposed portion of current common mode current. Common mode currents promote or encourage external coupling and radiation. In a dipole antenna, or any antenna for that matter, common mode currents in the antenna element are responsible for radiation. In the ham shack or along a feed line, common mode current is responsible for unwanted noise ingress, such as RFI, RF burns, and a host of other maladies. Common mode currents, in effect, bring the radiating system into the feed line or station equipment. Let me grab a nickel. Okay, so common mode currents or currents flowing in the same direction cannot exist inside a coaxial cable at any frequency where the shield is several skin depths thick. Shield skin depth serves to isolate the inside of the shield from the outer wall of the shield. Common mode or same direction currents can only flow on the outside of the coaxial cable shield. Differential mode currents or normal transmission line currents flowing on the inner surface of the shield wall. Differential mode currents or normal transmission line currents flow on the inner surface of the shield wall. Currents entering and leaving the shield and center conductor at each end of the coax line must be equal and opposite, or the cable will radiate. If a coaxial line is not radiating, currents in the shield and the center conductor are exactly balanced and opposite flowing. Both types of transmission lines, whether they're balanced, unbalanced, will have equal and opposite currents entering and leaving each conductor when they have minimal radiation. And then they have minimum radiation. That's why a ladder line works so well. The ladder line won't radiate because the signals in both conductors are opposite and equal. Okay, so how do you get rid of this? Let me grab one more nickel. There are several ways that we battle with common mode currents. One of those would be to create a coil of six turns, about 6 inches, in an HF antenna antenna line. Or we can actually use the ferrite sleeves that fit over the coax. That tends to stop the currents from flowing. And another way is to ground one end of the coaxial coax shield in order to allow the common mode currents to drain off the ground. All right, so any comments, questions, concerns, or disastrous moments, please call W4RFJ, and we'll see if we can't put this question to bed.
KG5ZI.
Oh, it figures it would be you. Go ahead, Tom. Come on aboard.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question. When it comes to the feed line, actually I want to make an observation and ask a question. I'll start with the question. Which is more effective, the ferrite beads or the coil, the choke at the base of the antenna? That's the first question. And then the second portion of that is, a well-grounded coax starts at the ground. I think that is the primary reason why they take every leg of a tower and tie it to ground rods. I think also having lightning protection in that circuit at the base of the tower or whatever antenna you're using would also be incorporated in that system too. Very important to do that as well. But static also is reduced when you do it correctly. So I was just wondering, though, it can't be overstressed that the importance of a ground at the antenna is imperative. But my question is, which one works better at the base of the antenna at the top? Would it be the actual coil or the ferrite beads, or do they work the same? Over.
Well, let's just put it this way. I've seen one or the other or both used. I've actually, on a VHF or a 2-meter antenna circuit, actually improved the gain of the antenna of a J-pole by putting a loop 1/4 wavelength below the antenna. And but there's just so much involved that, you know, that's why they call it amateur radio. We experiment with stuff, and I'll be honest with you, I have seen stuff work for one ham and not work for me. So it's just something that you'll have to experiment with. I can neither confirm nor deny the presence of equal or unequal usage of the ferrite sleeves and coils, et cetera, et cetera. Did that not answer your question, Tom?
No, actually, that's good. And being an amateur and being investigative, I think that's probably the best course of action anyway. Experiment with either one. We were talking about that last class on how innovative we can be by learning. Cool. Thank you. I think I've seen more people use the coil over the beads. Now, I don't know if that's because it's working for them or if it's because it's easier. I don't know. There might be a compromise there. All right, Chief, thank you. KG5ZI.
KG5ZI, this is W4RFJ with South Cars. And yes, you're right. There are trade-offs in everything that you do. And being able to work it out mathematically is a plus. I know when I was studying hard, I tried to work out the stuff, you know, with impedances and, well, anyway, the math will make an elephant stutter. But anyway, long story short of it is, it's a lot of fun to talk about too. So, okay, let's see if we can't get things moving along here. Next up is November Oscar 7 Oscar, a.k.a. the Sheriff of Nottingham. And I believe he's going to bring up Echo 4, Echo 10. What do you say, Sheriff? You going to give it to him good and hard?
Well, W4RJ and the South Cars Extra Class Review, NO70. Well, I will try to give it to him good and hard, but since I'm a sheriff only by nickname and circumstances, I don't think there's much clout in any tickets I may write regarding these extra class questions. But we have some good questions for you anyway tonight. Again, thank you each and every one of you for being here. Yes, Echo 4, Echo 10. Before reading the question, may I refer each of you to your familiarity or to a website search regarding the rising radio frequency NOAA's level floor in our physical surroundings, you know, wherever we may live or work. There have been a lot of discussions regarding the increasing floor level of noise and the difficulties in communications and reliability of signals, including even just the basic Wi-Fi within our homes or businesses that have fallen victim to this rising floor in noise levels. Therefore, I think that's one reason why this particular question is in this pool of questions for the extra class of Echo 4, Echo 10. Please, Savvy. All right, so the question reads, what might be the cause of a loud roaring or buzzing, AC line interference, that comes and goes at intervals? Let me reread that because of my accent. What might be the cause of a loud roaring, R-O-A-R-I-N-G, or buzzing, AC line interference that comes and goes at intervals? The options are arcing contacts in a thermostatically controlled device. Another answer is, a possible answer, is a defective doorbell or doorbell transformer inside a nearby residence. Another option is a malfunctioning illuminated advertising display. And the last option is all of those sources would be correct. All right, since this is a popular topic, let me see if there's anyone who would like to come in and give us the answer to this question. Please call now. This is N070. Over.
KN6FPS.
Well, thank you, David, for coming back. Yes, KN6FPS. Please help us with this question, N070. Over.
I would think that all of those would cause havoc with your AC interference. I know, you know, you see in those movies, you see the neon signs going bzz, 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 and things like that. And I think, and I know that doorbell transformers can make noise. So I think the answer would be all of the above.
Hey, Chief, how do you think he did? And you turned it right back to me, W4FJ, and I'm 7-0 over. I caught Chief at the coffee pot. Aha. Uh-huh. Yes, sir. Thank you, David. Thank you for letting me send a little thing over Chief's way. Chief is such a good Elmer to all of us. Yes, you're absolutely correct, David. All of those choices are correct. And let's break it down here. The reason that all of these choices are correct is that all of the choices are devices that have a cyclical or repetitive operational duty cycle. We know what a duty cycle is. That's time on and time off. The thermostat can arc when the temperature causes an activation. So a thermostat can cause a roaring or buzzing interference. A doorbell or transformer may interfere only when the doorbell is used or as the house line current from the power company changes over the course of a day. Or another possibility is that a malfunctioning illuminated advertising display may be off for a few seconds before turning the display back on to display the message again. Let me reset. So all of those choices then do cause a interference that can come and go at intervals. Now, these are just some of the reasons that each of these devices can cause a loud roaring or buzzing AC line interference. Therefore, the answer is that all of those choices are correct. So, David, I congratulate you, sir, on coming up with a good answer. KN6FPS, NL70, over.
Well, KN6FPS, well, thanks, George. I haven't encountered that myself yet, but you never know. KN6FPS.
Oh, very good. All right, so let's move on to our next question for the evening. That is Echo 5A04. Echo 5A04. The question is, what is the magnitude of the impedance of a parallel RLC circuit at resonance? Now, let me define a RLC circuit. That means R for resistance, L for inductance, and C for capacitance. Okay? So what is the magnitude of the impedance of a parallel RLC circuit at resonance? Who's setting? And our choices are that the magnitude of the impedance, A, is approximately equal to circuit resistance, B, approximately equal to inductive reactance, C, low compared to the circuit resistance, or D, high compared to the circuit resistance. All right. The answer to this one is that the magnitude of a parallel RLC circuit is approximately equal to the circuit resistance because it is a resonance. Okay? Therefore, the correct answer is going to be A. The magnitude of the impedance of a parallel RLC circuit at resonance is approximately equal to the circuit resistance. So, with that, that is going to be the end of my questions for the evening. I will be here listening. And with that, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Chief W4RFJ, who has some good RLC and other questions and further information on this topic. So, W4RFJ, floor is yours, NL70. Over.
George, don't you have the last question of the evening?
I stand corrected. I beg your pardon. Okay, thank you, sir. I'll be ready, NL70. Over.
All righty then. Good. Okay, so everybody's standing tall and ready to go. We're going to kind of expound upon what George was just talking about with a parallel RLC circuit. So the question I have is Echo 5 Alpha 16. What is the resonant frequency of an RLC circuit if R, being the resistance, is 33 ohms, L, which is the inductance, is 50 microhenries, and C, 10 picofarads, which is the capacitance? Would anybody like to gander at that question, the answer, please? Please call W4RFJ. Okay, you guys are crowding me too much. I'm not getting everybody all at once here. Anyway, let's look at the RLC circuit as a fundamental building block of many electronic devices. It consists of three elements: resistance, impedance, actually inductance, and capacitance, of which we can figure out what the impedance is, but that's not what this question is about. It's asking, what is the frequency? In its basic form, all three elements are connected in series. I think that's what they're looking at with this question. Other more complicated configurations are possible, used for a specific purpose, such as parallel RLC circuits. The RLC circuit has many applications. For example, you can encounter them in tuning circuits known as analog radios, known from analog radios, filters, basic blocks of equalizers, and music equipment can also be designed with a simpler RC circuit. Oscillator circuits converting DC signal to AC signals, such as, let's say, radio transmitters. The resonant frequency of the RLC circuit is a natural frequency with which the current in the circuit changes in time. This natural frequency is determined by the capacitance and the inductance. The resistance is responsible for losses of energy, which are present in every real-world situation. We'll cover that in just a minute. The formula for resonant frequency of an RLC circuit, a simple one, especially one in series, is the frequency is equal to 1 divided by 2 pi times the square root of L times C. So isn't that fun? If, for example, we assume an impedance of 50 microhenries and 10 picofarads, the resultant frequency actually comes out to 7.117625 megahertz. This frequency is typical of a radio transmission in the HF range. You can also use algebra to solve the following problem. What should be the value of the capacitance if you need an RLC circuit with a resonant frequency of 7.112 megahertz and you have an inductor with 50 microhenries? Well, you just use algebra to into the formula. frequency equals 1 divided by 2 pi times the square root of L times C, and you're good to go. You'll be able to figure out what that capacity is. Okay, so when you're talking about the resistance, it could be the parasitic resistance in the circuit. It could be an actual resistor. We get what we call the Q factor. The first characteristic number of the RC circuit is the natural frequency, of course, and the second is the Q factor. The Q factor determines how good is the circuit. If the Q factor is smaller than 1/2, then the oscillations quickly die out. When designing the RLC circuit, we should aim at getting the Q factor as large as possible. The formula for the Q factor of an RLC circuit is Q equals 1 divided by R times the square root of L divided by C. I'm sure everybody's got that memorized by now. Where the new symbols are, Q is the Q factor and R is the resistance. Let me grab a nickel. So for the circuit that we considered before, with L inductance being 50 microhenry and capacitance being 10 picofarads, the resistance R equal to 33 ohms, it leads to the Q factor plugging in the values of 67.75. We can redesign the circuit by either decreasing the resistance or increasing the impedance at the cost of decreasing the capacitance to keep the natural frequency constant. Keep in mind that the series RLC circuit provides low impedance at resonance, and a parallel RLC circuit provides a high impedance at resonance, which is usually the impedance, the circuit impedance being higher. Okay, let me see. Has anybody got any questions concerning RLC frequency and Q? Okay, I'm glad that everybody understands that. All right, so my next question is Echo 5 Bravo 01. What is the term for the time required for the capacitor in an RC circuit to be charged to 63.2% of the applied voltage or to discharge to 36.8% of its initial voltage? We have an exponential rate of 1. Another answer is 1 time constant. Another answer is 1 exponential period. And last but not least, a time factor of 1. Anybody got a response for that? Please call W4RFJ. Okay. Well, the answer is 1 time constant. Looking at a chart that describes time constants in an RC circuit, the actual formula for 1 time constant is T equals R times C. And that gives you time within seconds. So time in seconds equals R times C. So applying the time for 1 time constant, we can compare to the chart and figure what amounts to voltage will be available after the passing of 0.7 or 7/10 of a time constant, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 time periods have passed. I can tell you right now, 0.7 times the time constant will show you the half voltage level. Let's see. I don't know if you guys have access to this chart, but let's suffice it to say that 1 time constant is 37% discharge and or 37. Oh, I can't even read my own writing. Okay, so is there any questions on time constants? Please call W4RFJ. Okay, hearing no questions, I would like to pass the mic over to the Sheriff of Nottingham, N070 with Echo 5 B10. Go ahead, Sheriff. It's all yours, W4RFJ.
Well, thank you, Chief. W4RFJ and the South Cars Extra Class License Review Course. For those seeking their license or simply review or improving their skills, this is George, N070, Nottingham, Maryland. And we are looking at Echo 5V10, a question regarding AC current and voltage through an inductor. I think it might be prudent to do a real quick statement of a basic physics electronic principle here first before we look at the question. If we recall the definitions of voltage and current, voltage is the amount of push that is being given to the electrons that make up the electron flow. How hard are you trying to push them through the pipe called the conductor? Current is the flow of the electrons. That's the flow, not the push, but the flow of the electrons. That's the result of the voltage push that going through. So you have the voltage, that's the push, and the current, that's the actual flow of electrons. So that is, of course, from an earlier license, but it really applies to an understanding of this question. Let me reset. So the question reads, what is the relationship between the alternating current or AC current through an inductor and the voltage across an inductor? Rereading, what is the relationship between the AC current through an inductor and the voltage across an inductor? The first choice is voltage leads current by 90 degrees. Our next choice is current leads voltage by 90 degrees. Third choice is voltage and current are 180 degrees out of phase. And the last choice is voltage and current are in phase. Those are our four options to the question of the relationship between the AC current through an inductor and the voltage across the inductor. Resetting. So if you will remember from our earlier license classes discussing inductance and capacitance, that in an inductor, and this is asking about the current through an inductor or the voltage across an inductor, in an inductor, the voltage leads current by 90 degrees because it takes time for the voltage to build up the magnetic field that is present in an inductor. Therefore, the voltage leads the current in an inductor. Therefore, the answer would be that the voltage leads the current by 90 degrees. Conversely, current leads voltage by 90 degrees in a capacitor. As a capacitor charges to peak charge first, as the electrostatic capacitor components build up the charge. Once the charge is built up in a capacitor, the voltage now pushing the electrons onto the capacitor surfaces. The current will remain high until the capacitor builds up the charge, and then the current flows. So that's the difference in the phase between the inductor and the capacitor. Let me reset. Now, because this question is asking about the relationship between the AC current through an inductor and the voltage across an inductor, the proper answer is going to be that voltage will lead current by 90 degrees. So if you think about the flow of current and the presence of the voltage and its effect on the current, then you should be able to answer the question either way by simply thinking through the charging or inductive process that is occurring. Are there any questions on Echo 5, Baker 10? Please call now. This is NO70, over.
Fox Juliet with the comment.
I defer to the chief, W4FJ, NO70, over.
Thank you very much. Let's see. First of all, let me make this comment. When you're talking about inductive impedance or inductive reactants. Let's do that. Inductive reactants and capacitive reactants will cancel each other out. I look at inductive reactants as if it's positive and capacitive reactants as if it's negative, and if they both cancel out, your final resistance or impedance is resistive. If it's resistive, their current and voltage are in phase. There's no phase difference. Now, I like to refer, let me grab a nickel. I like to refer to my old friend Eli the Iceman. Now, if you look at Eli, spelled E-L-I, the Iceman, spelled I-C-E, and you take the center letter, L being inductive reactants and C being capacitive reactants, and you have an AC signal, okay? If it's going through, if your resulting reactants is inductive, then voltage will lead current. Now that, how much it leads current is dependent upon the resistance and the reactance in the circuit, and I can get into all kinds of math on this one, but just suffice it to say, Eli the Iceman. So in a capacitive circuit, the current leads voltage. Now, the amount of degrees can be a maximum of 90 degrees in both situations, but it can be 1 to 90 degrees, depending upon what the reactances and the resistances and all that stuff work out to, but that's another class. This is W4RFJ. Just remember my good friend, Eli the Iceman, when you got AC voltage and current going through an inductor and a capacitor. How's that for a tool? Sheriff, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chief. I think Eli the Iceman is an excellent tool. The only observation that comes to mind is that this particular question only mentions 90 degrees or 180 degrees or 0 degrees. So in this case, you don't need to worry about doing an actual calculation, but Eli the Iceman certainly will help you understand what is the correct answer. Yes, I absolutely agree. So, are there any other thoughts or comments regarding Echo 5B10? Please call now. This is NL70. Over.
Well, I got one more comment. You'll never have a phase difference between voltage and current more than 90 degrees. It's 1 to 90 degrees. And if anybody's interested in learning how to figure that out, I can do a one-on-one later on or another day. Anyway, back over to you, Sheriff W4RFJ.
Thank you, Chief. Yes, another excellent reason why the third choice of an answer is wrong, too. Very good. One last call for any of the comments on this question. Please call now, 70 over. Well, nothing heard. So that is the set of questions for tonight. KD0CDQ did mention earlier before Net that he had another commitment to go to. So let me see if KY6V is available with any further thoughts, comments, or the net close. If not, I'll take it from there. KY6V, are you available for close? NO70, over.
Yes, I am. Thank you, George, and you're correct. Mike had a salvation net control obligation here at the top of the hour, so I'm sure that he's long gone and in the midst of things. Roger, you got me smiling. You know, I'm thinking about Eli the Iceman, and I'm wondering what the heck ever happened to Eli the Iceman. He was the guy, when I was a kid, that used to deliver these ice blocks and put them on the front porch of the house. And he disappeared. The ice flow disappeared. And I'll never know why, I guess. All right, let me buy a nickel here, guys. Want to thank both Roger and George for a grand evening this evening. I also want to thank the students. They're being very prompt and very attentive, looking at our sign-in list tonight, as I have on the previous classes. You guys are there every class night, and I'm proud of you. So if you stick with us, we're going to get to this all together. Tonight's completion will mean that we have completed 40% of the course questions. This coming Sunday night will be featuring KC2 GA. That's Gary up in Syracuse, New York, and KB9 EWG in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Will be your instructors. Let me buy a nickel here a second. And they will be covering the section of E5 Charlie 01 through E6 Charlie 11. That's about 61 questions that will be covered on Sunday night. That's the 23rd of August, 7 o'clock. And at the completing of that session, obviously, we will be 50% through the course. So we're moving on with gusto. Do we have any other final comments or any questions that you guys would like to pose before we get the fat lady out here and we wrap it for tonight? This is KY6V, over.
KD9NDJ here with a response to Eli the Iceman.
You living where you live, Ken, in Illinois, probably are very versed on the subject. Go ahead, sir.
I can tell you what happened to Eli the Iceman. He got replaced by a compressor, which cycles in and out, and it causes AC noise in your signal. 89NDJ.
Oh, I'm glad I'm recording that. That's precious, Ken. Thank you very much. I'm glad to see your stick-to-itiveness also here on the classes. And I know you would be. All right, anybody else, please? KY6V.
Just want to say I didn't know Eli the Iceman personally, so I can't put myself in that age bracket there, Captain.
Yeah, I know. You're just a youngster, Chief. You know, I let the cat out of the bag earlier when I told you the story about my first car being a 1941 Mercury convertible 6-volt job, you know. So we'll leave it at that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're going to wrap it. We're going to let the server go back to normal use. Thanks for your attendance. We will reconvene the next class for the extra course presentation here on, as I said earlier, Sunday, August the 23rd. So you got a little time to take a look at that question group that I put out and throw the questions at us that you may like to throw at us. And we'll be very happy to see if we can answer them. With that, good night, ladies and gentlemen. The podcast should be posted by at least noon tomorrow, I think, on our website for this class. So you'll have four in total up there that you can look at and refresh your memory should you care to. KY6V is now clear, and thanks, everybody. Bye-bye for now.